a group of Hagbard's friends placed a notice in the Tageszeitung.
"We are angry and sad about the death of our friend. We are certain that he would still be alive if the police and media hadn't, through their criminalization and unscrupulous sensationalism, driven him to his death." Pengo was shaken by the news of Hagbard's death. It forced him to confront a horrifying reality. More than his first confession to the journalists in the noisy Berlin café, more than the interrogations by the West German authorities, and more than the bursting open of the story with the arrests 3 months earlier, Hagbard's death forced him to acknowledge the serious consequences of the case. Pengo knew, of course, that Hagbard was so unstable that his involvement in espionage probably had little to do with his suicide. Nonetheless, the pretense that none of this actually hurt anyone was now so obviously false. Moreover, Pengo sensed that this could put more pressure on him as the sole witness in the case. Turning state's evidence in July had not yet given him full protection, because his case in the espionage incident had been separated from the others. It could still result in a trial against him. Kohlhaas, the prosecutor in Karlsruhe, had different cause for concern about what effect Hagbard's death might have on the case. Hagbard's statements had been sufficiently tenuous, with enough assertions contradicting the others to make Kohlhaas wonder if he could use Hagbard's testimony at all. Kohlhaas had little choice but to base his indictment on what Pengo and Hagbard, and the three defendants themselves, said. The gathering of matching testimony was of utmost significance. The prosecution had to establish the connection between Marcus Hess and the laboratory in Berkeley. Kohlhaas's most promising witness was Cliff Stoll. In fact, if it hadn't been for the efforts of the woolly scientist, there would have been just the barest of threads holding the case together. Sergei's telephone number had been found in encoded form inside Carl's small pocket computer, but it wasn't enough on which to build an espionage case. Stoll's most valuable contribution had been his girlfriend's invention of the SDINet material, which had not only cinched the telephone trace, but also caused the appearance of the Laszlo Below letter. In fact, Kohlhaas viewed the Below letter as the most solid piece of evidence his office had to establish a link between Hess and the KGB. "Someone in Moscow must have dispatched Below to seek the SDINet information," he reasoned, "and since Stoll and the LBL hacker were the only two who could see the SDINet file, Hess must have taken the information and passed it to Carl, who in turn gave it to Sergei Markov. As far as Kohlhaas was concerned, there was simply no other explanation." Stoll was a witness of special importance because Kohlhaas had no physical evidence of Hess's hacking. When Hess's apartment was searched on the day of his arrest, the police found no printouts that implicated Hess as having been inside American computers in general and LBL in particular. In fact, the police found none but the most remote signs that pointed to Hess's hacking. It was the Bundespost's work in completing the trace to Hess's apartment that proved Hess was in the LBL computers. In June, the West German Federal Police summoned Cliff Stoll to Meckenheim for 2 full days of questioning. The police investigators were polite and deferential toward their American guest during the painstaking process of translating Cliff's account first into German that a judge unschooled in technical terms might understand, and then into official police German. For the most part, it was a matter of matching Stoll's sightings of the hacker with the dates and times of the Bundespost's telephone traces. They were aided in their efforts by a meter-high stack of printouts from the dozens of hacking sessions Stoll had monitored. Stoll was then taken to Karlsruhe to meet the prosecutor and repeat what he had said in Meckenheim before a magistrate. Stoll's deposition went smoothly. Kohlhaas was encouraged when, at one point, Stoll said that he saw data flowing over his monitor, then 2 weeks later saw the hacker break into another computer using complex commands he must have copied down or stored from the earlier session. That indicated to Kohlhaas that the hacker had been storing information. But there was one crucial point at which the prosecutor misconstrued Cliff Stoll's words. When Stoll was explaining what he saw happening on the computer screen at LBL, Kohlhaas concluded that Stoll had a piece of equipment at hand to prove that the hacker was actually transferring and saving the information he was seeing. "I saw him printing out screens full of military data, was one typical assertion of Stoll's, when what the Berkeley scientist really meant was that he saw screens filled with such data scroll by on his screen at the laboratory, with no way of knowing what was happening to the information on the other end. What Kohlhaas, with his limited computer knowledge, failed to understand was that it was quite possible that the hacker was doing nothing at all with the data he saw. It was, in fact, likely that the hacker disregarded the bulk of it, that he neither went through the time-consuming task of transferring it from Stoll's computer to his own, nor stored it on a floppy disk. But with Stoll using such words as print and download and copy interchangeably, Kohlhaas's mistake was understandable. The prosecutor concluded that he was pursuing a solid case. From what he could tell, the Berkeley computer manager had just provided the prosecution with ample proof, not only that Hess was the one hacking into LBL's computers, but that Hess's intrusions into LBL and other U.S. computers played an integral role in the dealings with the KGB. So Kohlhaas decided to call Stoll to the stand as the prosecution's star witness.
But Stoll was no expert in military matters. Kohlhaas's next step was to find a witness, preferably from the U.S. military, to corroborate Stoll's claims that what Hess had taken from LBL and other computers was of a highly sensitive nature. The names of the places whose computers Hess had compromised sounded sensitive enough. All Kohlhaas needed was for someone more qualified than Stoll to peruse the pile of printouts and offer an assessment. He contacted the Verfassungsschutz and asked that someone from that agency seek a U.S. official who would be willing to travel to West Germany and take the stand as an expert. It turned out to be a far more difficult request to fill than Kohlhaas had imagined. Although the Verfassungsschutz official assured Kohlhaas that he got in touch with the appropriate U.S. officials promptly, to the prosecutor's bewilderment, no one from the U.S. stepped forward to lend some expertise to the case. The National Security Agency had made its own assessment of the damage to national security that might have resulted from the West German hackers. It came in the form of a brief memo from Robert Morris, an agency scientist and the father of Robert Tappan Morris, the Cornell student who had released the computer worm through the internet the previous year. Morris's summary: looks like the Russians got rooked. But even Morris's opinion wasn't sent to Karlsruhe. Still, with the confessions of the three defendants themselves, and the promise of provocative testimony from Stoll, by late July, Kohlhaas felt confident enough to issue a 73-page written indictment of Karl, Hess, and Dobb. Officials at the U.S. Justice Department were quietly mulling their own plans for a possible prosecution. They couldn't charge the hackers with espionage, since the information that was sold didn't appear to be classified. Instead, the government wanted to charge the West Germans with unauthorized access to U.S. computers. Mark Rash, the same prosecutor who was working on the Robert Morris case, was considering ways to lure the West Germans onto American soil, make an arrest, and try them in U.S. courts. With their frequent electronic travels inside U.S. computer systems, Hess and Pengo were the Justice Department's main targets, and Pengo was the only one who came close to ensnarement. With plenty of time on his hands while he waited for his case to be decided, he toyed with the idea of going to the States in the summer of 1989 to visit some friends he had made over the network. But his lawyer pointed out the possibility of an arrest in the United States, and he stayed home.